All rise. The Chief Judge and the Judges of the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Hear ye, hear ye. All persons having business before the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals draw near, for the court is now in session. God save the United States and this honorable court.
Please be seated. Good afternoon. We are here to hear oral argument in the United States versus Major White. Captain Corman, welcome. Colonel Lowen, welcome. I understand you're reserving 5 minutes, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. And Captain Warren, welcome.
Yes, Your Honor.
Colonel Cordova, are we ready to proceed?
Yes, Your Honor.
You may.
Chief Judge Brand, members of this honorable court, may it please the court, an accused has the right to present relevant evidence in her defense at her court-martial. The appellant in this case was a health care provider, and she was charged with, among other things, making a false official statement on an Air Force credentialing form. Her defense counsel offered 6 Army credentialing forms into evidence, sought to have them admitted into evidence, along with 3 lay opinions, but the military judge denied her request for admission for both forms of evidence. The only evidence that the defense was sought to admit in this particular specification.
Well, Your that's not exactly correct. Weren't there 4 other pages that they sought to admit that were admitted?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I misspoke.
Okay. Sorry.
The issues in this case concern whether the military judge abused his discretion and violated appellant's right to due process and to a fair trial when he excluded the various 6 Army credentialing forms, as well as the 3 lay opinions regarding question D, which was the related to the question that she was charged with in specification 2. Your Honors, I hope to review certain pertinent facts about this particular specification and then discuss with you how the military judge abused his discretion and violated appellant's rights to due process and to a fair trial regarding these 2 forms of evidence. In 1987, when appellant was a teenager, she received a misdemeanor conviction. She went to college and graduated with 2 master's degrees. In 1995, she filled out an application relating to an Army application. There she revealed her 1987 conviction on a statement of health and professional status form.
I have a question about that, counsel. In reviewing that form, I note that it says that if she answers yes to any of the questions, that there would be a statement attached, and the matters that I saw in the record did not indicate that there was a statement attached. Do you know anything about that?
No, Your Honor. Unfortunately, that's all that I have was in the record, and I don't have any explanation for that. I would be happy to supplement it perhaps later.
Okay.
The important thing to keep in mind, Your Honors, is when she filled this form out, she was not active duty, and she did not have a professional license at this time. In 1996, she joined the Army and was active duty and later received a professional license. From 1996 through 2002, she regularly filled out credentialing documents for the Army. There were 5, at least, of these forms, a total of 6, but 5 were the exact same malpractice and privileges questionnaire.
Are those documents similar to the documents that form the basis for the charge or for the specification?
Yes, Your Honor, they are. There's differences in questions, but the key thing that the appellant would point out is that the Army form entitled Malpractice and Privileges Questionnaires has a series of 8 yes and no questions. The vast majority of those questions relate to such matters as privilege status, license status, and whether they'd lost some sort of clinical privileges or had a malpractice claim. So substantively, appellant asserts that they're serve the same function and have similar aspects. So there is a question about drug history that's on the Army form. That
and those documents were actually admitted into evidence, weren't they?
Yes, Your Honor, they were.
Okay, so then
no, sorry, they were not, Your Honor. The question that I just want to just clarify, the form that I'm discussing is the Army credentialing form. Appellate Exhibits XL, there's a series of 8 yes and no questions, and I'm Appellant asserts that this form is similar to the yes-no questions under Section 8 of the Air Force Form 1540. And that's the similarities, Your Honor.
But there's nothing in there that says something about a federal conviction or a conviction or being charged with a felony or a misdemeanor.
Yes, Your Honor. That's true.
So then how would that be relevant to?
The forms were offered to show the mental state of the appellant regarding the credentialing process, the type of questions that she was asked during her Army career, extensive Army career. At least six of these forms were offered, and they show what she experienced. And so the defense's theory was that when she looked at this, one of the theories was that when she saw the Air Force form, which asked about the convictions in 2006, she hadn't seen this question when she was in the Army and active duty and actually had a professional license. And she saw the practice history heading and interpreted the question based on the context. And the former Army forms would show that most of the questions were related to practice history.
Okay, and therefore what?
Therefore,
she made an honest mistake, or? I'm struggling to try to determine the relevance of the,
yes, sir,
forms to assist the trier of fact determine whether or not she had the intent to deceive when she completed the form.
Yes, sir. She had an interpretation, Your Honor, and it's a reasonable inference from both the context of the form as well as it could be argued from the prior information she'd supplied to the Army credentialing authorities, the questions that were relayed just to practice history, that she interpreted the question as applying strictly to whether she was tried while she was in a practice state, while she was licensed.
Do we have any testimony or information that this is how she interpreted the question?
No, Your Honor. This was a defense theory, and it's based on inferences, and it's circumstantial evidence, which is sort of the basis of this particular claim.
I have one more question related to the questions that my fellow judges have been asking. In the defense, in the government's brief on page 11 and 12, they make a point that the trial defense counsel argued these matters before the members, although they weren't allowed to put the documents into evidence. This issue was brought before the members in argument, and I'd like to hear what your response is to that point made by appellate government.
Yes, Your Honor. The trial defense counsel was able to sketch out a theory based strictly on the inferences of the Air Force Form 1540. Unfortunately, this was just a shadow of the theory. It was not supported by, for instance, the Army credentialing forms or by the reasonable interpretations offered by the three lay opinions. So it lacked the full force. The defense was not able to fully present and adequately present the defense in this case.
Thank you.
Yes, Your Honor. The six Army credentialing forms, which were not admitted, they were clearly relevant to show the appellant's mental state regarding the credentialing process. The Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces has commented that the bar for relevance is low on multiple occasions. When you consider the fact that the military judge also admitted the 1995 form, which the appellant had completed before she was in active duty and before she had a professional license, clearly it was unreasonable to exclude these six Army credentialing forms.
But the 95 form, in fact, asked a very similar question as about the felony or misdemeanor, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So there was a distinct difference between those four pages and the other six forms?
Yes, Your Honor.
As far as the question?
There was. But as far as her not being licensed at the time, that's the distinction, or active duty.
So let me get this correct then. I guess, so you're saying then that these Army credentialing forms are relevant to show the appellant's mental state about Air Force credentialing procedures?
No, Your Honor. They're directly relevant to her mental state regarding the credentialing process and the kinds of information she supplied to the Army, and that would have helped form the basis when she filled out the new Air Force form and saw this question. She hadn't seen a question like that since she's been in practice, and so it would go to show overall her mental state of the credentialing process as a whole.
But credentialing process is the Air Force credentialing process. It's not the Army credentialing process. Is that correct?
Your Honor, it's both. It's the general conception of both the Army, but the defense's theory is that it would possibly lead into when she filled out the Air Force form as well.
Well, I mean, when she filled out the Air Force form, she's filling it out to be credentialed in the Air Force, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So I guess what I'm asking is, are you saying then that her past experience in filling out these forms or similar forms in the Army, which is an Army credentialing process, informed her or somehow shaped her mental state with respect to what the Air Force credentialing process was going to be about?
Yes, Your Honor. That would have been sort of the background that arguably would have influenced her decision, as well as with the context of the Air Force Form 1540, that particular question D. The exclusion of these relevant forms was constitutional error. These forms would have shown the mental state, and it was vital for her to use these forms not only to show her overall impression of the credentialing process, but to show how consistent her answers were on these six forms regarding questions that she faced pertaining to practice-related issues.
How did the form show her mental state?
The six forms just show the kind of questions that she was expected to answer, and they show the kind of exposure she had in the Army for 6 years. They show the extensive background that she had the 6 years that she was in the Army.
Yeah, but if the forms that the Air Force, or the questions that are asked in the Air Force form are different, which some of them appear to be different, then there seems to be a breakdown in the logic.
Your Honor, it's more of the overall picture of the credentialing process and her mental state as to what the credentialing process is all about. Alternately, should this court find that this erroneous exclusion was not a constitutional error, under the test of United States versus Kerr, there was prejudice in this case. These four factors to consider when evaluating non-constitutional error include the strength of the government's case, the strength of the defense's case, as well as the materiality and quality of the evidence in question. The government's case here was not conclusive in evidence. They had to show, beyond a reasonable doubt, that the appellant filled out this form with the intent to deceive. And as trial counsel admitted, this was a tall order and had to rely upon circumstantial evidence. Meanwhile, the defense had two important factors and two theories which arguably could have created some doubt. The important factor to keep in mind is that the appellant had previously provided information about this conviction back in 1995 to the military. And so she had no motive to misrepresent. And plus, there was no expectation or any evidence of expectation of financial gain, which is circumstantial evidence that cuts against the government's case. In addition, there was put forth the theory that Ms. Peterson, who was the credentialing clerk at Dover Air Force Base, completed the actual question. And the strongest theory, which is advanced by the appellant, was that she interpreted this question in context to stand for whether, while she was in practice, had she been tried for a misdemeanor or a felony. Considering...
And that was based on the lay testimony that was also, they attempted to get in?
Yes, Your Honor. That was basically, as you asked earlier, Judge Thompson, it was actually put before the members based on the Air Force Form 1540, just on a reasonable inference based on the context of the question. She attempted to put in the testimony which would have bolstered the appellant's theory in this case, but was not allowed to by the judge.
But with McAllister, the case that you cite in your brief, and that was dealing with a DNA expert that was denied the defense, the court focused on that it could have changed the result. And with either the credentialing history or the lay witnesses, the two steps of expected testimony, and then the live witness who would have come in and testified, how would that evidence have changed the results when you look at the circumstantial, yes, but it looks like a pretty strong government case when you've got a 2005 form that the block where you have you ever been convicted was blank, the 2006 form where it's marked no, and then you go back and look at the 1995 Army form where it was marked yes. So it's not something that slipped her mind because it was something that happened in 1980s. I mean, she was well aware of this.
Your Honor, the evidence, let's start with the lay opinion evidence. This is opinion evidence that was provided from Lieutenant Colonel Samuel, who was a raider at the time, a chief nurse, who was a member of the credentialing function, as well as Captain Tresvant, who was a provider. There was also an opinion that was proffered from an individual who was a credentialing manager at Luke Air Force Base. These individuals knew this particular form and knew the process, and their lay opinion testimony would have met the standards of 701. It would have been helpful, and it would have gone to effect an issue, and that is the meaning of the question.
Helpful how?
Your Honor, I'm sorry.
Helpful how?
It would have been helpful because it would have shown the opinion of individuals who are familiar with this process how reasonable this alternate interpretation was that was advanced by the defense theory.
Why is reasonableness at issue? I mean, isn't the offense for which he's charged, he's just making a false official statement, a specific intent offense, a specific intent crime?
Yes, Your Honor.
And so if we're talking about mistake, then must the mistake be reasonable, or must it both be reasonable and honest?
Your Honor, I believe it needs to be honest.
Okay, then, so if it needs to be honest, if the mistake needs to be honest, how would the opinions of three other individuals who said that, the way I look at this form, I would have filled it out the same way she filled it out, how is that relevant? That would seem to go to reasonableness as opposed to going to honest.
Yes, Your Honor. It goes to the reasonableness of this alternate interpretation. All three of these individuals were familiar with this particular form, which was unique to healthcare providers. And the fact that they had this interpretation, which was similar to the interpretation that was in the defense's theory, would seem to support the overall defense's theory.
Yeah, but I guess the point I'm getting at is, isn't it true that for the trier of fact to believe that your client made a mistake, they only need to be convinced that the mistake was honest. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
They don't need to be convinced that it was an honest mistake and that it was reasonable.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so bringing in someone to help bolster reasonableness, how is that relevant?
It's relevant because it shows that this interpretation, which is part of the defense's theory, was not a fanciful interpretation dreamed up by a creative defense counsel, but that it was actually supported by other people in the field familiar with this form. And so it goes to bolster a part of the interpretation of D, which is really the basis of the appellant's theory. And given the fact that the lay opinion testimony was not permitted, and this opinion testimony would have very much likely bolstered the appellant's defense, likely would have created reasonable doubt. And go back to your question, Judge Thompson, because of that, and the defense was not allowed to put on these other documents which the appellant had filled out in the past showing consistency and knowledge of the process. And those forms are very similar in terms of asking questions related to practice history, that it would have created reasonable doubt and therefore would have resulted in a different result.
Thank you.
She had filled out the form in question well before she had received the, I guess, opinions of the three lay individuals. Is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
So then, in no way then, did these opinions help shape or form her interpretation of what the 1540 required?
Yes, Your Honor. I may. The lay opinions, again, were satisfied rule of evidence 701, and they were relevant. It was clearly unreasonable for the military judge to deny their admission into evidence because they were helpful to determining a basic interpretation of a question which was faced by the appellant on this form. And again, they would have buttressed the theory posed by the defense about interpreting this question in this particular way as pertaining to trials while she was in practice. It served as the linchpin of the defense's chief theory. And so the admission of these opinions was a constitutional error, and they were vital to the defense's case. Looking under the four-part test for non-constitutional error, Your Honors, if you were to find that this admission was non-constitutional error, then under these four aspects, again, the government's case is based on circumstantial evidence. There's no confession. And the defense has two important facts. Number one, the appellant has previously let the military know about this conviction, and as well as there is no financial motive. And there's two legitimate theories here. It's a relatively close case, arguably. And you also have the materiality and quality of the issue of these opinions. Again, they are either healthcare providers or members of the credentialing authority, and they're testifying, providing testimony about their interpretation of a question, which goes to the core of the government's case. Because if appellant's question is interpreted as being, have you had a conviction while you're in practice, her answer would be no. And that would be a truthful answer, and there would be no intent. So it's very pertinent to have these lay opinions there, and it would make a difference, Judge Thompson, were these opinions offered into evidence. And again, it's not a far-fetched figment for a provider to interpret question D in this manner, and it bolsters the appellant's overall case exponentially that this alternate interpretation was reasonable.
In reviewing the record, we saw in clemency the assertion that there's no AFI, there's no instructions to the form to tell how to fill out what does prior history mean. Have you looked into that?
Yes, Your Honor. There's an AFI, but there's no specific AFI that goes directly on point how to answer this question. And I could find nothing, and there was nothing in the record, except this is an ambiguity in the form itself. And it would seem that where there's an ambiguity, out of fairness, there should be lenience. In conclusion, by denying not only the six Army forms as well as the late opinions, the military judge abused his discretion. His decisions were clearly unreasonable, and the evidence likely prejudiced, and the erroneous admission likely prejudiced appellant's substantial rights. Appellant respectfully asked this court to set aside the findings for specification 2 of the additional charge. No further questions. I reserve my time.
Thank you, Captain. You okay? Good. Thank you. Captain Mayer?
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court. I'm Captain Charles Warner, and along with Colonel Douglas Cordova, we represent the United States in this matter. Neither the military rules of evidence nor the United States Constitution create the right of a criminal accused to present irrelevant evidence at their trial. Accordingly, the military judge did not abuse his discretion when he refused to enter into evidence irrelevant lay opinion testimony and dated Army credentialing forms which had no bearing on the charged offenses in this case.
Captain Warren, I'd like to stop you a second and piggyback on the last question I asked the appellant.
Yes, Your Honor.
It's with respect to the form itself. It says prior history, and there are no the AFI doesn't talk about how to fill out prior history. There's no form instruction. Why wouldn't that be confusing to someone who's trying to fill out the form, and wouldn't the person who's looking at that read it as history as a clinical worker?
Well, yes, Your Honor, and we'd like to address a couple of points to the court's question there. First of all, we need to take into account the totality of the factual circumstances here. The person filling out this form is a PhD holder, a major in the United States Air Force, very capable of understanding the plain language of a question which says, have you ever been a defendant in a felony or misdemeanor case? The second point is that the appellant in this case had the assistance of a medical credentials clerk, that being Ms. Beth Peterson, who spent, according to the testimony at trial, 20 hours over 8 different meetings going over any questions which appellant may have had on this form, and appellant had 0 questions on the charge defense question at issue, which is, have you ever been a criminal defendant in a misdemeanor or felony case?
But, Captain Warren, if you're following the form, the 1540, it goes through her school and where she's done her internship and so on and so forth and references, and then it gets to membership in professional societies and then practice history. And that's where the question comes, is practice history. That's not at the beginning where it's like, where were you born and where did you go to school, which covers your whole life kind of thing. It's in the practice history. And the questions to start with are, currently pending any challenges or revocations of your license, your certification? The next one's voluntary limitations on your license. It all appears to have to do with the licensing. So why wouldn't this other evidence be relevant to show that?
Well, ma'am, in this particular case, and the other evidence you're referring to, the Army credentialing forms, first off, ma'am, those Army credentialing forms did not have this specific question, and it's this specific question which the appellant has been convicted of answering falsely. Trying to say that other unrelated questions inform an entirely different question stretches the bounds of credulity and is beyond relevance as found by the military judge in this case. The question, although placed in a practice history context, was in plain English. It did not make any qualifiers on have you ever been involved in a misdemeanor or felony suit relating to medical malpractice or anything of that nature. It was straightforward. It was short in its terms. It was unambiguous.
Well,
and
if it's straightforward, then why do we have these affidavits from other medical personnel that say it's not straightforward?
Your Honor, respectfully, those other affidavits in this case, what other individuals may find to be confusing has no bearing on appellant's point of view in
this
case.
Well, didn't you just argue to us a few minutes ago that she had the help of this medical credentialing clerk for hours and hours and hours and had no questions?
Yes, Your Honor.
That would indicate that it does have something to do with it.
Well, the fact that she had no questions, ma'am, would indicate that she was not confused.
Well, but if she's interpreting the same way as these other people did, that it has to do with her practice because it's under practice history and not her whole life.
Well, ma'am, respectfully, we didn't have any evidence of how she interpreted that form specifically below based upon the evidence that came forward at trial. What we were left, direct evidence, may I correct myself, direct evidence. What we have is circumstantial evidence about the interpretation of a substantially similar question when we look just 5 months later in September 2007, when the appellant is filling out her EQIP questionnaire, have you ever been charged with or convicted of any felony offense? And again, the same answer, no. Two substantially similar questions, the same identical response. The evidence, circumstantial evidence in this case, clearly shows there was no confusion. There was an intent to deceive. Your Honors, moving into the primary question before us, its relevance. Simply put, Hal Appellant completed a handful of Army credentialing forms from 1996 to 2002, none of which questioned her prior criminal history, is wholly irrelevant to the question of whether she had the intent to deceive when completing this Air Force form in 2006. As the court is aware, MRE 401 governs relevance in this case, not the defense's theory of the case. While the bar of relevance is low, it is not non-existent. MRE 401 designs relevance based upon two components. One, probative value, and two, materiality. And it's materiality that I'd like to focus the court upon. Materiality being the relationship between the proposition that the evidence is offered to prove and the facts at issue in the case. Obviously, Your Honors, the facts at issue in this case are governed by the charged offenses. The only real things at issue here was actual falsity. Was the appellant actually a misdemeanor or felony defendant prior to, and to subjective intent. Offering in evidence of forms that do not go to any of that subject matter simply is not material to the elements in this case.
Well, let's focus on the lay testimony. Why wouldn't that meet the, in the defense brief, they cite us on page 19 to the case law that talks about the low threshold. Why wouldn't that meet the low threshold, especially when you look at Chief Judge Brand pointing out that, look at the questions and where practice history heads off, and there's your question buried under practice history. So why wouldn't those lay witnesses help at least meet the low threshold standard?
Yes, Your Honor. The danger in adopting a position consistent with appellant's posture in this case is that it would essentially allow the military rules of evidence to be rewritten to accommodate defense's case, and that's simply not the standard at issue here. Opinions of other persons going to overall reasonableness of interpreting this question were not at issue in this case. The issue in this case, as defined by the elements of this charged offense, was appellant's subjective intent. There was no evidence offered in these proffered testimonies that any of these people discussed their subjective confusion with appellant prior to her filling out this questionnaire. Therefore, objective reasonableness not being an element in this case is simply not material to her subjective intent, particularly where there was no discussion between these witnesses and appellant. And that's defense counsel's concession on the record in a colloquy with the military judge, and that is at the record at appellant's brief at 8 and record at 616 to 618.
If they had discussed it with her prior to her filling out the form, would it be relevant?
Possibly there would be relevance there, Your Honor, okay. if it had gone to the specific question at issue. That was not present here in this case, and the defense never asserted that it was at trial below.
Let's assume that these forms in the lay testimony was relevant and that the judge screwed up. What's the standard?
If the forms were relevant, then our standard is that the military judge abused his discretion in admitting this evidence.
Well, I mean, does it shift to the government to prove that the denial was harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, or?
Well, it depends upon how this court determines the gravamen of error that this court determines. Should the court determine that it's a error of constitutional dimension, then it is a prove harmless beyond a reasonable doubt.
Would you agree then that if the judge did deny, if these forms and if the lay testimony was relevant, and if the judge did deny the appellant the ability to put on these forms, put forth these forms, and also this testimony, that the judge, in essence, is denying the appellant due process, that is, the right to put on the defense?
Your Honor, we would not, based upon the very weak probative value and very tentative and non-existent materiality of these forms. As the court is aware, the test for constitutional error, as articulated in McAllister, is whether the presentation, whether the defense was prevented from presenting a whole defense, and in looking at exclusion of evidence, whether the deprivation of relevant material and vital evidence. In this case, the appellant was permitted to introduce Defense Exhibit C, which was the four-page credentialing form, which had a substantially similar question about
criminal
history.
Right, but we're focusing in on what the judge didn't allow her to put in, and whether or not that's a denial of due process.
Yes, Your Honor. In looking at whether the military judge's exclusion of this other evidence denied due process, we'd respectfully urge the court to consider the evidence that was permitted to be put in order to measure the quantum of the error and the quantum of the impact on defense's case, rather. In this case, there was no significant impact because the point that defense wanted to make was established through Defense Exhibit C, as demonstrated through trial defense counsel's argument, in which he repeatedly referred to Defense Exhibit C, getting to fully display defense's theory of the case. There are two arguments, one that the armor credentialing experience focused on practice history, and that might be a grounds for confusion, and two, that the difference between the Air Force and the Army credentialing forms created some amount of confusion. That was wholly established by Defense Exhibit C. That would have been in no way significantly buttressed by the inclusion of these other forms that didn't have that question. Indeed, it might cut against the defense's entire argument, because in the past, when appellant was asked, have you ever been convicted of a crime, she'd answered yes, demonstrating an understanding of this question. Years later, she answers no, and rapid proximity to answering no again, a mere 5 months later, showing this regression of integrity. Essentially, what happened here was that the members were permitted to review all relevant evidence in this case. Defense case failed, not because defense was prevented from administering irrelevant evidence, but because the overwhelming support of the circumstantial evidence in this case demonstrated full subjective awareness by appellant of this straightforward question on the questionnaire.
I'm going to focus you on the lay witness testimony that was not allowed in.
Yes, Your Honor.
In your brief on page 10, you cite a case in your footnote, United States versus Carruthers. And in that, the judge, the issue was bias, and the court focused on that the judge simply limited the evidence that was going to be before the court, not outright denied. Isn't what the trial judge did in this case outright deny the defense the evidence to make argument that those lay witnesses would have been able to put forth, which was out in the field, we interpret the history section to deal with dealing connected to our work, our medical work?
Your Honor, the denial of irrelevant evidence is not denial of a constitutionally cognizable claim for the defense. Because these statements did not go in any way, shape, or form to the subjective understanding of appellant at the time of filling out this questionnaire, they had no relevance, and the military judge did not err and refusing to admit irrelevant evidence. In fact, that was what the military judge was compelled to do under the Military Rules of Evidence, MRE 402, which forbids the admission of irrelevant evidence. The military judge would have been in error to admit this evidence had he allowed the defense to proceed on a theory of other people's subjective confusion alleged that had no impact on appellant's state of mind at the time of filling out these questionnaires. Your Honors, moving on, moving back briefly, rather, if I may, to the consideration of the credentialing documents. We would urge this court, operating as we are under the abuse of discretion standard, to, in reviewing the military judge's findings of fact, that these were not clearly erroneous. Not only were they not clearly erroneous, they were well established by the record. First off, there was never any question on those 1996 to 2002 Army credentialing questionnaires that had anything to do with criminal background history. They were distinct in time. They were distinct from a service. None of those findings of fact are clearly erroneous. And the military judge's conclusions of law proceed naturally and necessarily from them. Utilizing this abuse of discretion standard where the military judge's decision must be either arbitrary, clearly erroneous, or clearly unreasonable to be reversed on appeal, that's U.S. v. Travers, clearly the military judge's findings of fact and conclusions of law in this case must be sustained. The simple facts of this case were not contradicted by trial defense counsel below. The differences between the forms are manifest and unmistakable, and they simply have no bearing on filling out a completely different questionnaire with a criminal background question that was not present on these other non-related Army documents. Now, Your Honor, moving to consideration of Judge Jackson's prior question, talking about should this court decide that the military judge did abuse his discretion in refusing to admit these documents. Focusing on, we do not concede constitutional error would be applicable in this case, and therefore the court would have to determine the lesser standard of whether there was a material prejudicing of substantial rights, i.e., were the findings influenced by the exclusion of the evidence. And looking at the strength of the government's case here, we have strong circumstantial evidence that there was no mistake, that there was a subjective understanding. We have the 1995 questionnaire again, where appellant answered it clearly, unequivocally, and no evidence put forward anywhere that she was subjectively confused. We have the 2006 questionnaire with a substantially similar question, answered no. We have the EQIP questionnaire, and this is really where appellant's subjective understanding comes into clear relief when we talk about the use of circumstantial evidence. When you have two questions within a 5-month span, with all the other circumstances surrounding appellant at this time is established on the record below, with stress placed upon her from her workplace environment, we have a motive to deceive, and we have a clear subjective understanding of the question as demonstrated by her consistent answering of that question. And given all this, the members were well advised to find beyond all reasonable doubt that there was no mistake here, that there was a full subjective appreciation by appellant of the facts at issue. By contrast, the defense's case has some inherent weaknesses. And in this case, Your Honor, we're cognizant of the defense's supplemental citation of authority, citing Griffin versus California and U.S. v. Carter for the proposition that comment by the prosecution on the accused's silence or instructions by the court that such silence is evidence of guilt. We would say two things. First, obviously, trial counsel made no reference to appellant remaining silent below. Appellant, we can only imagine that this is attempting to take aim at the government's contention in the brief that appellant had a difficult decision to make with trying to make these Army credentialing forms relevant to her case. And that decision was whether to establish a foundation of how those forms are relevant to her state of mind by testifying. She elected not to do so. And making that comment in the brief, this is not in any way to undercut appellant's Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. Merely to highlight the practical difficulty that there are tough choices in litigation. Appellant made hers. Having received a ruling from the military judge that these were irrelevant because they showed no indicia on their face of how they might have created any subjective confusion, Appellant had a decision to make about the presentation of evidence in her case. She made that decision. As a result, she placed upon the government the burden, beyond a reasonable doubt, to prove her guilt by circumstantial evidence. The government did that. Appellant's contention to try to offer in these documents appears to have been an attempt to admit her subjective state of mind without her actually testifying to her subjective state of mind. The difficulty was that these documents that she wanted to do it with had no relevance on their own. At best, they had a modicum of conditional relevance, a concept that this court is very aware of, in which some other documents which don't have relevance on their own may have relevance if there is a linkage, something that brings them into the sphere of relevance. Here, there was no such linkage. The absence of the linkage was based upon practical trial decisions by the appellant, which the government does not question here, fully acknowledges the appellant's right to make them. We merely assert that the failure of appellant to offer relevant testimony in this case is not the fault of the government. It was the choice of the appellant. And moving to closing with the subjective intent, intent prong in the lay opinion testimony. We would urge this court, again, to consider that the landscape of relevance is not determined by the defense's theory of the case. The landscape of relevance is determined by the military rules of evidence in the United States Constitution. To contort the landscape of relevance in order to comply with defense's theory of the case is not the intent of these rules. Neither party has the right to present irrelevant evidence at trial. Those rights are circumscribed naturally as they must be in order to keep the case focused on the material issues. Those material issues are framed by the elements of the charged offense. The charged offense in this case did not go to objective reasonableness of the confusion of the question. It went to the subjective understanding of the accused, which was fully demonstrated by the government through circumstantial evidence.
I have a question.
Yes,
in the appellate defense brief, they make note on page 19 that the military judge failed to articulate any MRE 403 rationale. What's your response to that?
Yes, Your Honor. As an initial response, we would say that trial counsel did reference some MRE 403 concerns in their discussion of defense evidence, that it would confuse the members and the issues at trial. The military judges not conducting a 403 analysis, having found it irrelevant, it obviated the need to perform an MRE 403 analysis, Your Honor, because if the evidence is not relevant in the first instance, logically relevant, which is MRE 401, then there is no need to conduct a legal relevance review under MRE 403. We only get to MRE 403 if the evidence is admissible in the first instance. In this case, it was not. Therefore, the failure to conduct an MRE 403 analysis was not error. It was the correct thing to do in the course of the military judge's decision.
But obviously, if it was relevant and if the judge did do a 403 balancing test, then this court should give his ruling no deference.
Well, Your Honor, the absence of a MRE 403 balancing test would be something for the court to consider in deciding whether the military judge abused his discretion. This court is permitted to review those findings, those conclusions of law de novo under the clearly erroneous standard. Even under a de novo review, though, given the lack of material linkage between the proffer testimony, because it focused on objective reasonableness, versus the charged offenses, which focus solely on subjective intent and belief, there was no error to refuse to admit that testimony.
In the MCM, when it's talking about Article 107 and it's discussing what needed to be proven, and it makes comment about an honest but erroneous belief is a defense. Why wouldn't these lay witnesses be assistants, especially when you look at the impressive credentials of these witnesses, years in the field, multiple people who could come in and provide us information, especially given it honest but erroneous belief? Why wouldn't that be relevant evidence and should have been before the court?
Well, Your Honor, it'd be entirely relevant if they were on trial for their understanding and false completion of the medical credentialing document. Here, though, their subjective belief is not what's at issue. It's the appellant's subjective belief. Appellant's subjective belief was not impacted by their subjective belief. That was established firmly at trial, colloquy between the military judge and defense counsel. Well, they didn't even talk to her before she filled out the form, correct? Correct, Your Honor. Yes. But it just goes to the overall reasonableness. Overall reasonableness is not the standard. It's what did appellant believe at the time. To say that these people who had no interaction with appellant regarding this issue at the time that she committed her crimes in this case, to say that that is relevant evidence of what her state of mind was simply is not sustainable under the facts of this case, Your Honor, because, again, of the absence of linkage here. Now, the only relevance that this testimony may have had from third parties is if this was someone in a position to go to the actual falsity of the statement, if this was someone who could step up and not just say, not only was I confused, but I know that the Air Force medical form is not asking about any criminal offense. It's only asking about medical service-related criminal offenses. If it had testimony on that actual falsity, there would be the relevance. But testimony from unrelated third parties about their subjective interpretation is simply not relevant, given the charge elements in this case, Your Honor. Thank you. And if there are no further questions, may I briefly conclude?
You may.
Thank you, Your Honor. The military judge did not abuse his discretion in refusing to admit irrelevant lay opinion testimony and dated Army credentialing documents in this case. Government urges the court not to permit the appellant to redesign the rules of evidence to contort relevance to comport with defense's theory of the case. Thank you.
Captain Corman?
Yes, Your Honor.
Your Honors, the Air Force Form 1540 was ambiguous, and the evidence we have of that is the lay testimonies from individuals familiar with this form who had reasonable differences of the interpretation that actually coincided with the interpretation offered by the defense's theory. There was no clear written guidance on how to answer this particular question. Looking at the 1995 form and the 2006 form, there were two different forms. Context does matter. In between those intervening years, the appellant had complied with a series of Army credentialing forms that were asking questions primarily specifically geared toward her particular practice. Mistakes happen. PhDs can make mistakes. And the fact that PhDs and the fact that we've got providers and even chief nurses who have reasonable differences in terms of how to interpret this form, that illustrates the form is just clearly not clear. The rules of evidence are designed to ensure a fair trial. In this case, the appellant was not given a fair trial because she could not put on the evidence she needed to defend herself. The exclusion of this evidence, the forms, as well as the lay opinions, was clearly unreasonable in this case. The government referred to the EQIP questionnaire, which asked a different question. It asked the question of the effect that had the appellant ever been charged or convicted of a felony. Now, this offense happened 20 years ago, and you certainly wouldn't expect a teenager to know whether she'd been charged with a felony. So that is not relevant to this charge and this issue.
Would you say that these lay opinions, or are you trying to say that these lay opinions show that the appellant's mistake was honest, or that these lay opinions show that the appellant's mistake was both honest and reasonable?
Your Honor, we're using the lay opinions to show that she had a reasonable interpretation of the question. The theory is that she was honestly mistaken based on her answer and the context of this ambiguous question. So it kind of goes both ways, Your Honor.
That it was honest and reasonable?
Well, Your Honor, that it shows that it's a reasonable interpretation, and in her case, it was an honest mistake. The fact that other people who were experienced in this area had a similar interpretation shows that that the interpretation was reasonable, and it goes to an honest mistake as well. reasonable, educated people can make honest mistakes. And the military judge improperly limited the defense's ability to put on a defense in this case. Any questions? Your Honor, I'd like to close. The military judge abused his discretion when he denied appellant's efforts to defend herself by excluding the 6 Army credentialing forms and the 3 lay opinions, which crossed the low threshold of relevance. By preventing the appellant from adequately presenting her chief defense theory with the supporting evidence necessary to establish reasonable doubt in this case, these clearly unreasonable exclusions prejudiced appellant's substantial rights. Thank you.
Thank you for the arguments. We will be issuing our opinion in due course. Court is adjourned.
All right.